Today in Movie Wellers, we talk about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's time for Movie Wallace. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And yes, D as well.
Movie Wallace is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news, and general banter in theatres on DVD, online streaming, or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you. Tripped over my tongue there. Three podcasts in a row will do that to you.
Yes.
So, this podcast, I think we've been highly anticipating for a long time, the new Quentin Tarantino movie.
It's a Tarantino special podcast.
It's the kind of event that we only get to celebrate every, how many years?
He doesn't really crank them out, does he?
A couple of years. When was Hateful Eight?
Last year.
2 years ago.
No, Hateful Eight was 2 or 3 years ago.
2 or 3 years ago.
Yes, he's obviously having too much fun with life. Time is flying by.
It's just flying by.
In fact, we should look that up, Hateful Eight. When did that actually
I'll do that.
Come out? That came out in...
I'll tell you. It came out in 2015. Goodness, really?
Has it really been 4 years? Wow.
Really? I thought it was last year. I really thought it was last year. Anyway.
So, this being a kind of an event, Tarantino movies are always an event. We thought we would do our usual segment of I can't find anything to watch on VOD with a Tarantino theme to it. So we always talk about how much there is out on streaming, and Tarantino's movies, they kind of come and go, but I guess in honor of the new release, a lot of the movies are currently streaming on Netflix and Amazon Prime and various other services. So let's all pick a Tarantino movie and
okay.
Make a recommendation for somebody who wants to maybe check up, you know, catch up on the back catalogue. So guys, what is in your Tarantino pick list?
So mine is Pulp Fiction, and Pulp Fiction, I actually was the first Tarantino movie I watched. I hadn't seen Reservoir Dogs. I went to see Pulp Fiction knowing nothing about this and came out a converted diehard Tarantino fan.
Awesome.
So Pulp Fiction stars, a lot of the usuals. His muse, Samuel L. Jackson, John Travolta made a comeback. I think he had like some career renaissance after this movie. Bruce Willis, Tim Roth, Uma Thurman made into an icon after this movie. Just a great movie, and I loved it because it was the first time I'd seen time played with so well.
The whole sequence thing.
Yeah.
You know,
I've never seen that done before so smartly, and it just was spectacular.
I just remember how hard it pushed my buttons at the time. I didn't recall seeing anything quite as provocative up until then. I mean, I'm sure there are movies out there which fit into that category, but Tarantino somehow managed to bring that to the mainstream. And, you know, both shock and
smartness.
Well, I can't remember being shocked and laughing as hard as I did at some of the punchier moments in the movie.
I mean, I feel like this was pre-Sopranos, where we never got to understand bad guys other than henchmen. And this really is a story about two henchmen, in a sense. So I think that's kind of why I loved it so much.
Yeah, it's a good thing this is a Tarantino show, because there's a lot to say. I'm like you when I watched Pulp Fiction in the cinemas. I just came out going, huh? Like, you know, I was so puzzled by it. I didn't see the genius in it. Now, mind you, this was a long time ago. I was not...
1994.
Yeah, not developed, I think, to fully recognize it. It's still not my favorite
I'm with you on
Tarantino
that,
movie by a margin. I mean, I think, you know, he's done far better. But, you know, maybe I need to just sit down one day and watch it like scene by scene again and really analyze it from where I sit right now. My favorite movie of his in the last decade or so is Inglourious Basterds. And I think that movie is just genius at every level. I think, you know, he's already, Tarantino has won 2 Oscars, and I think rightly so. They've both been for screenplay. They haven't been for Best Director, although he's been nominated thrice for Best Director. His 2 wins are for Pulp Fiction and Django Unchained. But I think he has not written dialogue which is better than what's in Inglourious Basterds. Just the scene which opens the movie with
Christoph Waltz,
you know.
Who won the Oscar
for Best Supporting Actor, you know. That's just some kind of marvel in screenwriting. And I love how complex it is, how revisionist it is. I think everything that often seems like an indulgence in his movies really comes across to the service of the story at hand in Inglourious Basterds. So I have great respect for that movie. Love
it's
that film.
It's just so smart. Again, I love Tarantino for how smart he is. It's like, I always find his movies are like that game of Where's the Queen? You know, when you have 3 cards and people are moving the queen about in the middle and you have to try and keep your eye on it. That's right. How I kind of, that's what Tarantino movies have been up until this point for me.
And I say that because I'm not saying that as a, like you are an unvarnished fan of Tarantino.
Correct.
Tarantino really rubs me the wrong way with some of his movies. I mean, I'm not a fan of The Hateful Eight. I'm not a fan of Django Unchained. But I think when he does it right, there's nobody quite like him. And he did it right with Bastards.
To which I blur Great Big Raspberry. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Inglourious Basterds, but I'm also a fan of The Hateful Eight. And that's going to be my streaming pick simply because it was recently re-released this year.
Director's cut, right?
A director's cut, but they rather cleverly chopped it up into 4 little episodes. So rather than make this into kind of a 4-hour long episode, I mean, the movie's long anyway. It had a near three-hour running time. So the additional material he wanted to insert into the movie. So they chopped it up into kind of 4 separate little acts. And I don't think...
And this is on Netflix.
This is available on Netflix. And so if you look up at The Hateful Eight, you'll see 2 versions of it. One is the original movie, and the other is what appears to be a miniseries. And, you know, I'm glad that the original movie was trimmed to the way that it was. I think the episodic content, while it adds more footage to the movie, doesn't necessarily add more more to the movie. So, you know, but nonetheless, it's really fun to revisit those scenes, and the episodic nature of it allowed us to watch it over several evenings, and it was kind of a satisfying experience to do that. So not my favorite Tarantino movie by far, but I still think that The Hateful Eight is totally deserved of anyone's time. And I think the way of doing the director's cut in this manner was kind of a fun thing to do, make it into a little movie series. But Rashmi, Pulp Fiction, Yazdi, you're going to pick Inglourious, and I'm going to say Hateful Eight. I'm still waiting for the Kill Bill movie to be cut into one movie. So there's been rumors for years and years that he was going to do a re-release of Kill Bill as a single movie rather than 2-parter, and I think that would be quite an extraordinary thing to see come to life. If
the
they
latest
could capture
rumor, yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't no, need to no, cut no. you off. The latest rumor is actually he might be doing a Kill Bill 3. I don't know how, because Bill got killed in part 2, and no spoiler there, but he's teamed up with Uma Thurman, and they're thinking about it. We'll talk about this more, but you know, he has famously claimed, Tarantino has in the last 5 years now, that he's only going to make 10 movies, and mm-hmm. he's had it, and this is the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which we're going to discuss, is his 9th one, which leaves room only for one more.
Well, it's 10th, actually, because there's one called The Death Wish that didn't make it out
right.
much, so it, one could say it could be 9, it's 10.
He's done
Kill
like,
Bill could be 1, so he could have 2 more in the, you know. But yes, famously, he has said he will only do 10.
Right.
And this was officially the 9th, as it says on the poster.
Correct. And he has made no qualms about his desire to do a James Bond movie. He has made no qualms about his desire to do a Star Trek movie. And any studio in their right mind should just let him do that. I think either one would be, I would love to see him do either Star Trek, or I would love to see him do James Bond. But anyway, I don't know what they're waiting for.
I would love to see how he imagines space.
Yeah. I don't know what they're waiting for, but anyway.
So I'm guessing, just before we get into the review of the latest entry in that catalogue, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, your favourite movie of his would be Inglourious Basterds?
Kill Bill, volumes 1 and 2, followed by Inglourious Basterds.
Okay.
That's 3!
No, I'm saying that's number 2.
Oh, okay.
Number 3 would be...
he's so sneaky.
Number 3 would be Jackie Brown. Pam Brown.
Yeah, we know what you were saying, yeah.
Jackie Brown, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting, because my orders are pretty similar. I do hold Reservoir Dogs in very high esteem as well, so that appears somewhere in that list. But Kill Bill's probably at the top of my list too. Yes, yeah, I can see the box set over there on your shelf, and kudos for having that, because those are movies. And Rashmi, what would be your favourite if you had to pick one? Because they're all...
I love them, Joe. That's like...
I know. It's like
too difficult.
Trying to choose your favourite M&M.
I mean, Inglourious Basterds is so incredibly smart and clever. So I think
that would be your fave.
Yeah, but then very, very, very closely, like by a hair, Kill Bill. And I can't decide between the volumes. Probably volume 1, because again, it was something so different. And I love the emergence of the Uma Thurman character when we see her as just this person in a coma.
Yeah.
So to start from there and end up where we do at the end of volume 1 is just an incredible ride.
Yeah.
But I couldn't decide between those. Inglourious Basterds. Just, cannot compute.
All right. So I guess it's time then to talk about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So who is going to introduce that one, Rashmi?
Yeah, I'm going to do the IMDb intro, because I think it's kind of short and sweet. And we have been asked by the studios not to give away any spoilers or, you know, spoil the viewing experience for those of you that haven't seen it. So, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, a faded television actor and his stunt double strive to achieve fame and success in the film industry during the final years of Hollywood's golden age in 1969, Los Angeles. So again, written and directed by Quentin Tarantino, and this has such a full cast, but it's headed by Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt, and followed very closely by Margot Robbie. And then there's a whole host. I mean, honestly, there's so many people in this. Some of the usuals: Al Pacino's here. We've got Kurt Russell. We have Luke Perry. This was his last movie film before he passed away.
Bruce Stern is here.
Yep,
Lena
Bruce
Dunham.
Stern is here. Yep, Lena
Timothy
Dunham.
Elephant.
Ruben
Timothy
Willis,
Elephant.
Emil Hirsch.
Emil Hirsch. Yes.
Did you mention Kurt Russell?
Yes.
Yep. Maya Hawke.
The list goes on.
You know, there's children of actors and actresses.
Dakota Fanning is here. Yeah. Yep.
So many, many, many people. Yes. So, once upon a time, we went to the movies and saw this movie. So, who wants to start?
I'll go.
Yasti.
There's a lot I want to say about this movie. I will start off by saying I love this movie. I think people who are going to go see a movie expecting a Kill Bill or a Hateful Eight or a Django Unchained will be surprised. They might be disappointed even. For me, this is what Tarantino should be doing. This is a grown-up Tarantino. This is a Tarantino who is kind of... He has always been a very visceral, out there, hyper-violent kind of filmmaker. And we haven't seen introspective Tarantino. And this is introspective Tarantino. I'm by no means saying this movie is perfect. It has its faults. It's kind of shapeless. It has a middle which kind of drags. There's all kinds of issues. But I thought it was a great movie when I walked out. And as I've thought about the movie, it hasn't left me in the days that I've watched it. My esteem has even grown greater and greater. I can talk more about it, but I think this is just brilliant.
Joe.
It's one of the best movies of the year. Sorry. One of the best movies of the year, easily.
The hard thing about covering any kind of Tarantino movie is managing the anticipation of it, right? It always feels like such an event in one's life. I mean, you know, there are those directors for whom we all have great love, and he's definitely, you know, notorious, but also I think the three of us are, as we stated at the beginning of the podcast, huge fans. So in sitting down to watch this one, I was really trying hard to manage my expectations. And I think other than for the fact that this feels slightly disappointing as a Tarantino movie, expecting to get the Tarantino movie type stuff, but brush that kind of expectation aside, this was just really accomplished filmmaking. I think, you know, the only concession that we get to you know, Tarantino's normal you know, voice within movies is towards the end of the movie with Act Three. That's where we get the kind of movie that we typically expect to see from Quentin Tarantino. But before that, we get this amazing buddy movie between Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio that says a lot of things about a lot of things. In particular, it has this nostalgia element for the way that Hollywood was. I didn't appreciate all of its reference. I'm not encyclopedic and I'm not quite a movie geek. And this period of Hollywood kind of predates a lot of my specific knowledge about movies. But you can see the fondness for the time. You can see the fondness for, you know, the way that movies used to be, the less cynical era. So, yeah, like you, SD, I felt that this movie has a lot more to give. I want to see it again, and I think it will stay with me. Rashmi.
Oh, my. What to say about this story that is faction, part fact and a lot of fiction, that is more a vehicle to show incredible acting versus a really good narrative that hangs together as a cohesive story. I really enjoyed this, like you, Joe, but I'm disappointed by the lack of cleverness and extreme wit that is normally Tarantino. So at the beginning, as we were doing our sort of favorite movies, the thing that I've always loved about him is just this incredible smartness and ability to kind of hide the queen. And I couldn't find that here. I make it sound like I hated it, and I didn't. I just didn't love it as much as I've loved the other eight Tarantinos that came before it. So again, I think this is... we'll be talking about Leonardo DiCaprio's performance at the end of the year. This is absolutely,
not
I think,
Brad Pitt.
Maybe best supporting.
Let's have that debate.
But what I'm trying to say is this is absolutely an infomercial for Leonardo DiCaprio to win that Oscar.
Let's debate that.
Yeah, this is very unlike, this is the most unlike Tarantino movie that I have seen.
Which is probably why you love
which it. Which is exactly why I love it. And I don't want to
You've been saying this for years.
I've been
you?
Saying this yep. for years, and not to beat the drums, I really had a problem with The Hateful Eight. I found it a truly hateful movie. And I wrote a little piece on our blog called 8 Reasons Why The Hateful Eight is Not a Great Movie. And it seems like this movie is a response to that. I mean, he doesn't...
He read it, clearly.
He read it and he changed the script. No, but, you know, he doesn't use the N-word. I have a real problem with how he uses the N-word. You know, there is no female character who's a punching bag in this movie, which is usually a thing with a lot of his movies. He always seems to end all of his movies in this Mexican standoff where everybody kills each other. He seems to, in his more recent movies, he ratchets up the tension, everybody's killing each other, and there's just like corpses lying on the floor at the end of the movie. And by that same token, he's almost afraid to have his characters be happy at the end. And
don't give anything away, remember.
And I think he corrects a lot of these things in this particular movie. I've long said he should do a comedy, or he should do like a spy movie, action movie.
Yeah,
something
like
where, you know, things
a rom-com.
Rom-com even. Like things which normally trip him up. He gets very indulgent. He loves the things he loves. You know, he gets super violent. And I think this time... He's reconsidering his mortality. He is reconsidering his relevance. And, you know, he's at his midlife or maybe late midlife period where he's thinking, where am I going to stand in the history of movies? And I think that the Leonardo DiCaprio is a stand-in for him, who is kind of questioning, you know, he has had a very great checkered past, but in today, where does he stand? How is he relevant? And he's kind of using that, you know, as a way to talk about it. And I really liked how gentle and affectionate the movie is about these two main characters. You know,
oh my God, yeah.
The Leonardo DiCaprio, who is this fading television star who is trying to find a place in cinema, and his stunt double, who actually is more of a friend and who's kind of his, you know, person who takes care of everything. And
well,
there's this
ultimately it also shows the reliance, right? Like,
right.
without the actor, there is no stunt double.
Correct.
So there's
that's a very
kind
good point.
Of
yeah, they're both rely
theme
on each other.
Within that.
And there is a sweetness. I would have never thought mm-hmm. I would see sweetness in a Tarantino movie, but there's this, it's never surfaced, but underneath it, there is a sweetness about these two individuals. And you can almost make the case that the last hour of the movie has nothing to do with the first 2 hours of the movie. And, you know, I think a lot of people get impatient with the first 2 hours because there isn't much plot. It's about Tarantino imagining a world that existed in the late 1960s, you know, in the late 1960s, when everything was perfect. The grunginess of the 70s, the disillusionment of the 70s,
and
the war,
extravagance.
The extravagance, the war, the violence, the racism, all of this hadn't reared its ugly head. 60s was still a very positive, sunshiny place. And I think it's his nostalgia for that which comes through, and it comes through beautifully. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, just hand over the best production design Oscar to whoever has done it in this movie. I mean, there are scenes, they are all outdoor scenes, again and again in the streets.
I was doing
of,
the same thing.
In the streets of
I
Los Angeles.
I was looking at every single car to make
the,
sure.
For the life of me, forget the cars, the street signs and the boards and the you know, the shop fronts and everything is so wonderfully realized. I don't know how they did it. I don't know if it's all CGI. I don't know if they shut off those roads and they reprinted everything. The production design is incredible. So, and it's a movie about movies. And I love movies about movies because, you know, the DiCaprio character is trying to find things. And there's a lot of criticism about the Sharon Tate character in the movie. We'll get a little bit more to it. But I just... the more I think about it, the more I'm in awe of this movie.
So for all the reasons that you liked it, yes, there are all the reasons that I didn't like it. Mm. So here's the problem I had. I like the buddy aspect of it. I love that, in fact. But that doesn't make a movie. Just watching two buddies interact doesn't make a movie. And so what we end up with is this maze. We start down a path and then we enter this maze. And we have side story and backstory and down the rabbit hole that adds to the color of the characters, but it doesn't move the story forward. And so all we end up with is this very beautifully realized character, you know, character sort of study of these two people and all the experiences they've had, either together or separately, that make them who they are. But now what? And so then we're in this situation where we have to add this other element of crazy, like the Charles Manson story then comes along and it feels bolted on. I couldn't relate to what the Sharon Tate story is doing. And then we have this, well, I know why the Sharon Tate story is there because of the Charles Manson story, but they're just disconnected. And so I do love each of the scenes as we're kind of going through each of the scenes, but it doesn't make a nice package for me. It's not a narrative. It's a great character study. And I love that. But it just didn't have a story that I could kind of like say, wow, what a clever, smart Tarantino movie.
And I think in part it's because, I mean, you talk about his indulgences here. One of his indulgences, and it's really hard to talk about this because it is a huge spoiler and, you know, you've got to avoid spoilers, is the revisionist aspect of
his faction,
this story, right? So, you know, you call it faction, so factual fiction kind of thing. Yeah, I mean, he makes a very bold storyteller's choice here to change certain events that we understand to be fact. And at first I was a little disappointed with that as I kind of wandered away from the movie. I was like, really? Okay, I wish we had seen, you know, maybe the drama of what we knew had happened. But then I'm like, there's other movies about that. This is a filmmaker's dream about what could have been, you know, of what would have happened. You know, and I read this in I won't take credit for this, but I read this in another review where, you know, there's a common quote about the Manson murders, which suggests that, you know, the positive vibes of the 1960s ended the day at the time of that first murder, the Sharon Tate murder. So, you know, Quentin Tarantino, I guess, is having this this moment where he wants to enjoy the world for what it was before then,
yeah.
Right? And the movie is very much about exploiting that feeling. It's a time, you know, certainly before I was on the earth, and so I don't really relate directly in the nostalgic way to that. But I did enjoy this idea of Hollywood being what Hollywood could have been. It was a very uncynical look at the movie industry. And I just had a kind of a warm and fuzzy feeling all the way through it. Can we, and just before I let you talk there, yesterday, I know you want to interrupt. The Sharon Tate character is emblematic of that. Mm. She is absolutely nothing Bingo. Other than a daydream of a character. She has almost no dialogue. She's this wonderful,
she's, you know, an ideal.
Yeah, the way he shoots Margot Robbie here is just this dreamlike,
gauzy,
floaty.
Yeah.
And
it's
ethereal.
It's not overtly sexual or perverted in any kind of way, you know, because there's a lot of like shots of legs and short skirts, but it's of this kind of fairy like, you know, source of energy and loveliness in the world, right? So I don't know, I felt like the whole movie was him just trying to be that. The source of, you know, the characters played by Brad Pitt and Leo DiCaprio, there's a source of great tension there in terms of the dynamic that they have. But again, the movie completely uncynically plays that for what it is. Rashmi, you said it earlier, right? There's a symbiotic relationship between the two. But in many movies, you would take that tension and use it to have them attack each other, right? They would say, well, you here they're just... they understand the nature of the relationship. The Brad Pitt doesn't have any envy of the act, you know. It just works really uncynically, which is surprising when we talk about Tarantino movie whose hallmark is pure cynicism.
Yeah, I mean, so coming out of Cannes, where it was the opening night film, I think there was a lot of criticism about the Sharon Tate character, and people said that Tarantino, you know, the one main female character in the movie doesn't have any dialogue. And so I was kind of sensitive to that before I watched the movie. And she has a lot of dialogue. Every time she spoke, I was like, well, she has a dialogue here, she has a dialogue there. But I think it's not, I mean, Tarantino is the most meticulous, most obsessive, you know, most just so filmmaker. So I think if he wanted Sharon Tate to be a very true to life character, he would have made her that. But I think he has intentionally made her this ideal of this uncynical, golden, perfect age of Hollywood before it was corrupted by the real world, if you will. And that kind of started, like you said, with the, you know, with the Manson murders in Hollywood. And he's kind of looking at her as that last vestige of that golden era in Hollywood. And he's seeing it deliberately through those gauzy eyes. I do agree with you completely. It's two separate movies. And the first part, which is just these two characters, the Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt characters, it's very formless. It's very, there's no strong narrative flow through it. But I think by virtue of the fact that he's such a good writer and he's such a good director, there is tension there. I mean, there's that one day, I think the movie spends about an hour in the one day in the life of those two guys where DiCaprio goes to play this special appearance character in this other television show where he kind of breaks down and he is seeing his whole world kind of, you know, fall to bits, while at the same time, you know, the Brad Pitt character is almost, you know, going on an adventure where he goes to the Spahn farm where the Manson acolytes are there. And at the same time, while Leo DiCaprio's characters' fortunes, if you will, are falling, the fortunes of the Sharon Tate character is rising, because she kind of, you know, our good friend Glenn Heath has written a great review of this movie, and he says she goes to the cinemas to see herself in a movie, and it's the recognition of her immortality. She sees herself on the screen and she realizes, oh my God, this is going to last forever. And, you know, so I do see some tension there. It's not... That's why I'm thinking it's going to disappoint a lot of people who want that very kinetic, driving storyline, and you won't find it for the first 2 hours of the movie.
Well, and therefore it doesn't exist in the movie at all, because it's a 2 hour and 20 minute movie. And so, I think it's a masterclass in creating character. right? And us really understanding who, there's no doubt in my mind that we don't know who Leo DiCaprio is and who Brad Pitt are now, as they are in their characters and what life they've lived and what brought them to this point. What I'm saying is that there's just no connection other than that as a movie.
I think
and again,
is.
That's great to yeah. watch. The acting is sublime. I mean, maybe we can talk about Leo's performance for me, it was sublime. It's not that different to his Wolf of Wall Street character. It's very extreme. It's really pushing on the boundary of caricature to me, which is what I think that Wolf of Wall Street character was in the end. But there's so much breadth. There's so many different pieces we get to see him play by virtue of the fact that there's so many of these false little movies that are filmed, right? So we get to see like a back catalogue of Leonardo DiCaprio's filmography.
Look, I mean, this movie is called Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And there's no question in my mind, it's a reference to Once Upon a Time in the West, which is a Western movie. And you know, Tarantino loves Westerns. Yep. His last two movies were Westerns. And he gets to indulge his love of Westerns by making, you know, the DiCaprio character here, you know...
A cowboy.
A cowboy, you know, who acted in Westerns. And on television, he had a bounty, whatever.
Bounty law.
Yeah.
So he gets to indulge a lot of his usual obsessions. You know, he gets to indulge by making these mini movies. Rashmi, I like you, I thought when I was watching the movie that you could almost start at the last 45-minute mark and play that as a movie. You don't need the first hour and a half. But the more I completely see the correlation. But I think the one sin that Tarantino does is somebody from India watching this movie is going to be completely scratching their head. So you need to know a little bit going in about that time, you know, the people, what actually happened with Sharon Tate, who the Manson people were. Because if you go into this blind, or if somebody doesn't have any knowledge, it'll not make any sense.
Yeah.
And I think the way the two parts are connected is by virtue of the spoiler. So, I we can talk about it afterwards. DiCaprio is very... I mean, Tarantino is known for perfect casting, right? Impeccable casting. And as Glenn Heath has said in his review, he has made his career by resurrecting actors who have been past their prime. Yes. Look at Pulp Fiction. You know, Travolta was, you know,
and
past
Willis,
his prime.
Bruce Willis, too.
Bruce Willis was past his prime. Uma Thurman. Look at Pam Grier. Look at, Keith Carradine in Kill Bill. Look at, you know, he takes actors who are kind of left behind. Daryl Hannah. You know... And he puts them, he gives them the glory that they deserve in his movies. That is what this movie is about. It's about this character who is losing his glory. And in a way, Leonardo DiCaprio is a perfect choice. He's won his Oscar. He might be past his prime. And he's lost some of that, you know, puppy baby looks. You know, he looks older now. And, you know, there's a lot of close-ups in this movie. And he uses DiCaprio perfectly to... represent this person who might be past his prime, who's figuring out if he should give in and sell out or not. And DiCaprio does it very, very well. But for me, and I think, Joe, you feel the same way, the standout by far, by a wide margin, was Brad Pitt. I mean, Brad Pitt is so good here. We forget, you know, because he gets to play very special characters. He kind of likes the more darker characters. But Brad Pitt can be such a charismatic, light-footed, you know, lose performer. And, you know, he is so charming here. And, you know, he's gold. He's lit like gold in the movie.
Those abs were pretty 300, I have to say.
But I haven't seen him be this loose and humorous since maybe like Burn After Reading. That's the last movie I can think of.
This is the best act.
And he's so good here. I mean, we forget, this is why he's a film star, you know?
Yeah.
I was kind of reminded. And he plays it note perfect.
Yeah, this is the best I can remember seeing Brad Pitt. And I don't say that lightly because he's one of my favorite actors. I mean, he just, you know, he nails a lot of the roles that he plays when he's cast appropriately. But here it's just kind of, there's so much that's understated. There's so much that's behind the dialogue in this. You know, the character's not particularly talkative.
Yeah.
But yet you know, the nature of his relationship with the DiCaprio character, you can see through the eye. I mean, there's just so much to, and you know, the scene with Bruce Dern, for example, you know, where he has to kind of deal with, that was to me the most tense
that
scene
was
in the
very
entire
tense.
Movie. I mean, that was when I suddenly, again, I think the movie kind of earned that tension by being so relaxed at the beginning. Then suddenly it did the great
like
Tarantino flip.
I was like, don't go in the cellar. Don't go in the cellar.
Yeah, you know, the camera angle tightened up. And we were in a very, you know, especially I think background knowledge does help us appreciate the danger.
Yeah, I was going to say, had we not seen, Joe and I were lucky enough to watch the movie Charlie Says,
which is a small movie earlier this year that we saw
at the Tribeca Film Festival, which is literally a movie about
the Manson murders.
The three women who end up in prison for doing the actual murders, right? So it's the actual murder. If we hadn't seen that movie, mm-hmm. I think this would be a very difficult, like you said, Yazzie,
a very
difficult movie to watch.
Yeah.
Because you would have no recollection why he's on a movie set. Because actually it turns out that movie set
ranch,
did
right.
belong to that guy, that played by Bruce Dern, and Charles Manson did have the cult there. So I feel like it's a lost opportunity.
But Pitt, to me, again, just going
sorry,
back to
yeah,
that.
Sorry, yeah, yeah, yeah. He was good. He was good.
But he stood out so much above DiCaprio, who I felt I've seen do all of this same stuff before. So, you know, I think that was amazing. Margot Robbie here, I mean, I don't think she had an awful lot to do, but what she did perfectly well. And it's not just because she's eye candy. Rashmi's looking at me with that wrinkle going, oh, God, you know, another male drool over Margot Robbie here. But there's an authenticity to the performance that you believe. And maybe it's the way it's shot. Maybe it's the way the narrative kind of takes a step. But the fact that this character goes to see herself perform in a movie, you know, there's a naive sweetness mm-hmm. to it that I think could, again, be really like, could have been really missed and played incorrectly, but you believe it. And again, maybe that's just because Tarantino's taking us on that journey of believing this idealized time. But again, I think she worked really well in this. And I don't know if that's a difficult or easy thing to do for an actor, but I bought it in spades.
I did. That's one of the highlights. That scene is one of the highlights when she goes to watch herself. And, you know, I wrote this in my notes. You know, there's so many scenes in this movie where contemporary actors are juxtapositioned in old movies. So there's a scene where the DiCaprio character thinks, oh, you know, if only I had been picked instead of Steve McQueen
right,
in The Great Escape.
Funny, yeah.
And you show him instead of Steve McQueen in scenes in The Great Escape. So, you know, technically Tarantino is completely up to it. But in that scene where the Sharon Tate character goes to see herself in the cinema, the film clip that you see is not of
correct.
Margot Robbie. It's the original Sharon Tate.
Yeah.
And it works because her character as imbued, it looks like that, not just physically, it's in spirit, similar to what you're seeing on the screen. So that's a great gamble that they take because it could be totally jarring saying, well, she doesn't, that's not the
that's
same
not
person.
Her, yeah.
Yeah. So that's pretty incredible.
So are we ready to wrap this one up?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'll go first. I think the biggest, and this is a movie that I really, really, really want and need to see again, because I think the weight of expectations does somehow taint the viewing experience upon first watching. So I would very much like to watch this again. It was 3 hours long. It zipped by for me. I mean, I didn't feel that this movie, you know, people, you mentioned, yeah, it kind of drags in the middle. I didn't really feel that, I'll be honest. I mean, I enjoyed spending the time with this. So, you know, sidestepping the fact that this is a Tarantino movie, if this had been any other filmmaker, I think I would have enjoyed it in the moment an extra point more than I'm going to give it today. But I think this movie is going to stick with me forever. So I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10, which I think is stingy, because I think this movie is really finely crafted. But I do see this one rising up in my estimation over the years by virtue of the fact that it worked so well in the moment.
Yes, Dee.
Yeah, so like I said at the outset, everything that I've complained about Tarantino in the past or what I found annoying about Tarantino, this movie kind of bypasses all of those things. And so I like the affectionate, self-analyzing, nostalgic, sweet Tarantino. And I agree the DiCaprio Pitt portion may be a hard sell for some people, but I completely bought it. I saw it as a representation of Tarantino asking himself, where do I stand? You know, where do I stand as a filmmaker? So I just loved it. This movie is by no means perfect. Like I said, there is, you know, it requires some pre-knowledge before going into the movie, which is always a down for a movie. And then there is this weird voiceover in the middle of the movie, you know, suddenly Kurt, like a lot of voiceover, like, you know, a lot of talking, and that really turned me off because, you know, he doesn't need voiceover. You know, he's a master filmmaker. So, and you know, you can make the case the first part of the movie is a little formless, but there is so much I love about this movie. I think it speaks to the end of the golden era of Hollywood, and it's so impeccably crafted, and it features such wonderful performances. You know, this is the answer to my prayers about Tarantino. So I think it's one of the great American films of the year. You know, as Glenn Heath has said in his review, a 9 out of 10. I really liked it so much.
Wow.
I cannot wait to see this again. I really cannot.
Wow, Yasti.
Yes.
Okay, so once upon a time, there was a great director storyteller called Quentin Tarantino, and then he took a bit of a wrong turn. Maybe your next will be your best. I was going to give this a 5 out of 10.
No.
You have convinced me that there's a little bit more to this. 6 out of 10.
Really? But you...
You guys look like shocked.
Well, no, I'm looking at you because I think, Rashmi, you were giddy with anticipation for this. So I don't want to put thoughts in your mind or words in your mouth, but I think I have this sense that you're a little unforgiving because you didn't get another helping of, like you said, and you said it yourself, you know, the plot twisting surprised me at every moment, Tarantino. There aren't any real surprises in this movie. Well, again, yeah. Spoilers notwithstanding, the movie is very conventional in many ways during its early part, and that's not what we've come to expect from Tarantino, right? We've come to expect these, you know,
where's the queen?
These dynamic, you know, he does very well. The Mexican standoff is the ultimate culmination, but the thing that I always love about Tarantino movies is the tension that comes from the shift in power dynamics that he constantly does in every scene. Think about any scene in a Tarantino movie, and you go into a scene where the character holding the card suddenly ends up with being the character without the cards at the end of the scene, and that is thrilling. And we don't have that here. So, you know, when you've come to expect that and it's not there, you're wondering, you know. So I think I got very quickly that this was going to be not that movie, and then just let it be what it was. So, yeah, I feel like, again, I don't want to put thoughts in your mind, Rashmi, but I think you'll come to like this more.
Yeah, I think it definitely needs a second watch. It's very content heavy. And at 3 hours long, you know.
Plus, if you're expecting that constant twist and that constant turn, it comes... It's too little and it comes very late. For somebody who's expecting... I'm talking about the average Joe Blow who's going to watch the next Tarantino movie. They, you know, they'll keep waiting for it. And then, like I said, it may be too late and too little, but this is not a regular Tarantino. I think this is probably his most autobiographical movie, I think. So, yeah, I worry about the commercial prospects for the movie, but we'll see.
Yeah. All right. Let's wrap up the podcast for today. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed our analysis of this. Let us know if you wanted us to do a spoiler cast, because I think we would quite happily talk about this one with a spoiler context. So,
we get to have dinner and talk spoilers now, right?
facebook.com/movierollers as well. Until our next podcast and our dinner. Too many movies, too little time. But goodbye from me.
And me.
And me as well.